Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mesner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Melita, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's program, Updates on Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, or CLL. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And we also have many other organizations that have worked with us to promote this program. And because of all of this, we have so many of you on the call today. We have over 762 participants on this call, which is a record for this program, for a CLL program. And you actually come from all over the United States, from all different regions of this United States. And we have international participants from Australia, Brazil, Canada, Denmark, Japan, India, Italy, Korea, Pakistan, the Philippines, and the United Arab Emirates. So you really come from all over the world and clearly are a group of information seekers. Today's program was supported through grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Cephalon Oncology and GlaxoSmithKline. And I really want to thank everyone for their support of our program today, and particularly the Lymphoma Research Foundation for really making this program possible through these grants. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's lots of information about the many different organizations that have worked with us to actually promote the program. And there's information about our speakers and information about also the topics that are going to be addressed today. There also is an evaluation form, and I'm going to ask all of you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs they would like us to offer going forward? This is the beginning of the new year, and we are planning many programs, and we very much appreciate your suggestions and feedback of topics that you would like us to offer. So we take your recommendations quite seriously, and indeed today's program is one that many of you have asked for, and clearly here you are today. So tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to provide those services. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Stephen Coutre, and Dr. Coutre is going to address the overview of CLL, new treatment approaches, the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options. And I should say that Dr. Coutre is Associate Professor of Medicine, Director, Hematology Clinic, Stanford University School of Medicine. He has tremendous expertise in this area, and we're delighted to have Dr. Coutre with us today. Dr. Coutre?
Thanks for having me. So I'll start out by just giving you a brief overview and really review some of our treatment options. And the message I hope to leave you with is that things are changing in CLL. I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about the future. So this is a disease, as many of you know, of older individuals. The average age is about 70, and most people, when they're diagnosed, are without symptoms. So it often comes up because somebody has a blood count done for another reason and they see an elevated blood lymphocyte count. Very easy to establish the diagnosis. We don't need to do bone marrow exams typically, even though as a leukemia, of course, it involves the bone marrow and the blood by definition, but we can do the flow cytometry on the blood and confirm our suspicion of this type of leukemia. We have very simple clinical staging system that has nothing to do with CT scans or PET scans that allows us to group individuals into three broad categories that roughly correlates with the extent of the disease and also correlates to some degree with prognosis, what to expect for the disease course. And it also actually helps guide us in making decisions about when to treat. As many of you know, probably the majority of patients who are newly diagnosed are without symptoms, have lower stage disease, and we generally recommend watchful waiting, or as many of my patients call it, watch, or wait and worry. But that's still very much the standard approach for most patients with CLL. There have been attempts to look at early intervention trials using other factors to make decisions about treating people early, but that's still very much in the investigational arena. So I think when you're initially diagnosed and you talk about the disease and what to expect and what your stage is, there's, as a physician and as a patient, there's a number of questions that really often come to mind. For example, what's this disease mean? What's my prognosis? Do I need treatment? When should treatment start? And then, of course, if you make a decision about treatment, what's the choices? What's best for that individual? And finally, and I think often overlooked, is what's the goal of treatment? So although we can apply these broadly to groups of individuals, it still comes down to applying these to that individual, to you, in your discussion with your doctor about what's going to be best for you. So we have to take a lot of factors into consideration, including your preferences, your age, your other medical conditions when we make these decisions. We do have some newer prognostic factors that are different than just the stage. I'm not going to talk about those in detail, but I want to emphasize that those give us information about what to expect on average. By and large, they do not influence our decision about whether to treat somebody or what to treat them with. There's a few exceptions, and we can get into that in the Q&A, but they are prognostic factors, so things like CD38, ZAP70 expression, certain chromosome abnormalities, immunoglobulin mutational status, all of those can inform us about what to expect on average in a given individual with some of these features. But again, I want to emphasize that they do not dictate when to treat somebody. We don't treat somebody who's asymptomatic simply because they have some of these features. So I think that's important to keep in mind. When we do make a decision to treatment, somebody has symptomatic disease, big lymph nodes that bother them, night sweats, weight loss, a large spleen that's causing them discomfort, or if they have significant anemia, a low red blood cell count or a low blood platelet count, then we'll start talking about treatment. And we have a lot of treatment options. Many of you on this call, I'm sure, have received treatment for your disease. You've heard of drugs like fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, and then an antibody called rituximab. So I think it's fair to say that the combination of those three, FCR, is a very common regimen that we use. There's been two very large experiences with it, one at MD Anderson Cancer Center with Dr. Keating and colleagues, and then the Germans did a nice randomized trial using this regimen and demonstrated, for example, that the combination of the three is better than the fludarabine and the cyclophosphamide alone. So adding our antibody to some of our standard drugs is beneficial. There are ongoing trials in this country, for example, looking at that combination versus just the fludarabine and the Rituxan alone. There's another regimen called PCR. So we have a lot of different options, and as I mentioned, we have to tailor that to some degree to an individual patient, what's going to work best for them. There's a newer drug, newer at least to this country, called bendamustine. That's also widely used. There's been experience using that as initial therapy as well. And fortunately, there's a very nice, large, randomized trial currently underway in Germany comparing that FCR regimen with the bendamustine plus rituximab. So I think another example of where a well-designed clinical trial is really going to give us useful information about therapy or for patients who've not had prior therapy. So what should be our number one regimen as an upfront therapy? Of course, all of these combinations have been used for patients who require retreatment, for example, and that decision about what to use is complex. There's not a straightforward algorithm. You know, this is my second-line therapy. This is my third-line therapy. Again, we have to take into account that individual. How long did they respond to the first therapy? How well did they tolerate that? What their other medical conditions are? What we want to achieve in that individual? Are we looking just for shrinkage of the lymph nodes? Do we want to also clear out the bone marrow? How good of a response are we looking at? So that's what we think of as physicians when we're trying to give advice to our patients for subsequent treatment. Now, when we treat individuals, of course, we can assess response, and I think everyone should have a bone marrow exam done after their initial treatment regimen to see how good that response actually is. It's important information, not just what your exam is like, what your blood counts are like, but how good have you how well have you treated the CLL in the bone marrow. And that can be a very important information for us. So when we talk about responses after treatment, it really should include examination of the bone marrow. There's ongoing clinical trials looking at sort of maintenance-type strategies, a drug called lenalidomide, for example, or Revlimid, which is an oral drug, a pill, is in clinical trials after second-line therapy, asking the question of, if you take this drug versus placebo, does it add value? Will it prolong the response rates? Will people even live longer by taking this as a maintenance? So that's an interesting question that's the subject of an ongoing clinical trial. Now, we also, of course, have individuals who've had a lot of prior therapy and have gone through a lot of these standard agents and maybe have not had a good response, or they've had a lot of treatment and are running out of options because they're no longer responding to these drugs. So we have some other options. There's another antibody that's recently approved called ofatumumab. I think it remains to be seen what role that really will play in the standard treatment of CLL. So I think, in my view, the jury's still out on how useful that will be. And then we have other investigational agents. There's a drug called flavoperidol that's in ongoing clinical trials. But to me, the most exciting agents that are out there are some real novel drugs, drugs that target the leukemia in a very different way than our traditional chemotherapy and in a very different way than our antibodies. So these are oral drugs that target some of the signaling pathways within the CLL cell. So in a simplistic way of looking at this, with a better understanding of how the CLL cell works, we've been able to develop therapies that target very specific pathways. We want to shut down some of these pathways so we can allow the CLL cell to die the way it normally should. Unfortunately, with the leukemia, often it doesn't die the way it should, a process called apoptosis. So very different approach to targeting the disease. And there's several drugs to mention. One is called ABT-263. This is a drug from a company called Abbott Pharmaceuticals. It targets a pathway which has been of longstanding interest to investigators in CLL. And, for example, we're using that in combination with some of those common regimens, the FCR or the bendamustine rituximab, to see if it will add benefit to our standard therapies. So that's a very interesting drug in active clinical trials. We also have two other oral drugs. One is a drug called Cal-101 from a company called Calistoga. This is a pill that we've used by itself for treating patients who have had generally a lot of prior treatment. And we've just opened a trial where we're combining it with the rituximab antibody for patients for initial therapy, older patients, at least for now, those over 60 or 65. But we have seen really dramatic results in patients with very extensive disease who have largely run out of treatment options. And in addition, we've seen that the drug is remarkably well tolerated with very few side effects. Importantly, very few side effects on the normal blood counts. So with a lot of our drugs, we're limited because it suppresses our normal blood cells as well. But at least with this drug so far, we've seen very, very promising results, and it's moving forward very quickly in combination with these standard drugs that I mentioned. The final investigational drug that I'll mention also has a funny name, at least right now, PCI-23675. It targets a protein that we call BTK, another one of these signaling proteins. And again, in patients with CLL, as well as some lymphomas, we've seen extremely exciting results with responses in the majority of patients with very extensive disease. We tend to see these responses with both of these agents very early, even a week later when someone comes back to the clinic for assessment. We've used this drug by itself as initial therapy for older patients and have seen complete responses. So it's, hopefully the beginning of a new era where we're using much more targeted drugs that are extremely well tolerated, that are very easy to take, and that lend themselves very well to continued treatment. And I'm hopeful that over the next several years, we may be able to integrate these kinds of drugs into our standard care for patients with CLL and really start asking the question of whether we can actually cure patients. So I think for the first time in many years, we have some exciting drugs that really offer hope to change the course of this disease. So I just wanted to give you an overall view of where we are with CLL, and I think by the nature of these drugs, I want to emphasize how important it is to consider clinical trials when you're choosing treatment, because it's only through these kinds of investigations that we truly make advances in treating this disease. So I'll stop here and turn things over to Dr. Brown.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Couture, for just an outstanding presentation, for really setting the context, and really for all the also promising new treatments that are available as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer Brown. Dr. Brown is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. She's attending physician lymphoma program, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Dr. Brown is going to address tips to manage complications and side effects, quality of life concerns, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. Dr. Brown?
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be able to participate today. Dr. Couture did a wonderful job providing an overview of CLL treatment. And when I was asked to talk about this topic, I thought that probably the first thing I should talk about was actually how to manage the watch and wait phase, or as Dr. Couture put it, the watch and worry phase. Because so often my patients tell me that it's just very hard to be told suddenly out of the blue, often you feel very well, that you have something called a leukemia, but we're not going to treat it. And it's a very big adjustment. And I see people struggling with it frequently. And I think the best thing that I can say from talking to many patients about this over the years is that insofar as possible, I would try to continue to live your life as you had been before. Obviously, you want to educate yourself as much as you can about your diagnosis, and people obviously turn to various sources of information. I think the Lymphoma Research Foundation is an excellent source of information, Leukemia Lymphoma Society, American Cancer Society. I do find sometimes that people who spend a lot of time looking at discussions on the Internet and searching the Internet sometimes feed anxiety and without sort of an ability to buffer that by talking to someone, talking to their doctor, or listening to this call, for example. And so sometimes people find it helpful if they do an initial period of education, and maybe if you are able to connect with other individuals in the same situation, that can be helpful, although sometimes I find that people don't find general cancer support groups all that helpful, because oftentimes the people in those groups are not in a similar type of situation. And so it's often better to educate yourself and try to continue living your life as you had been. And I think that people are able to do that often, over time, adjust better than people who find themselves reading privately about information that can sometimes be scary and that may never apply to you. People often ask, too, about a number of different symptoms that people have mentioned to me soon after diagnosis, which they're not sure if they are related to COL or not. And oftentimes, with early-stage, newly diagnosed CLL, most of what people experience that they're concerned may be related to the CLL isn't. And that is really good, obviously, because you can continue to live your life fully and continue with your usual activities. There are a few things that sometimes people notice that I think might be related to the CLL but are not really necessarily something to worry about. Sometimes people are a little bit warmer or may have an increase in mild sweating, not the drenching night sweats that we always talk about that are worrisome for people and tend to be progressive and don't go away, but just being a little bit warmer overall, that can stay stable for many years and is really not worrisome. And people do often feel a milder fatigue, which can sometimes increase. Sometimes it's hard to sort that out when people are newly adjusting to the diagnosis, if it might be related to anxiety and concerns about the diagnosis. But a mild amount of fatigue is something that people sometimes experience. Generally, that isn't a reason why we think about treating people, because unfortunately, our treatments are often induce fatigue themselves. And so as long as people are able to carry on with most of their activities, that's something that we generally encourage people to incorporate into their lives and activity. Managing the anxiety that comes with this is, I think, very hard. And obviously, people turn to their families and close friends. Most of us have social workers available, as well as therapists who potentially specialize in working with individuals newly diagnosed with CLL or other diseases. There are clergy people. Whatever sources of support that people can derive, I think, to talk about things can be potentially helpful in sort of starting to make the adjustment to the diagnosis. And, of course, the urgent question that pretty much everyone has is sort of what can I do to try and slow the progress of the disease or to try and help stay stable for as long as possible. And unfortunately, this is something that is both not studied as well as we would like and also a little bit hard to study because oftentimes we don't know what would have happened if we didn't do an intervention that we're studying. But so as a result, we don't really have any good, solid information about advice that we can give people for things that can potentially slow down the CLL in this phase. I generally recommend that people carry on with the health maintenance that primary care doctors recommend, that we all recommend for trying to optimize your mental and physical well-being. And so this would obviously include getting plenty of sleep, trying to manage stress as well as you can, but again, carrying on with your life. Diet-wise, there really are not any solid recommendations that we can make specifically for CLL, but general health maintenance generally favors a low-fat diet and lots of fruits and vegetables. It's potentially helpful with many cancers, so I tend to favor that. And I'm a big fan of exercise as well, insofar as people are able, just as a way of increasing your strength, reducing fatigue as you build up more exercise tolerance over time. And it can also be a great way of managing stress and anxiety. And all of these things help you be in the best shape possible to live your life and to deal with your CLL if your CLL ends up needing to be dealt with. And so I'm not sure that's very satisfying to people because obviously you want some intervention, some pill that we could take to potentially stop this. And, you know, I don't know how to answer that, but the one thing that I would say is that if you flip it around a little, the flip side is that it's never, whatever happens with your CLL is not in any way your fault because you didn't do X, Y, or Z. You know, because you were a little stressed, you're not making your CLL worse. And that's something to know and to hopefully realize that you don't have to bear that burden that you might do something that might worsen things, because it, unfortunately, the CLL tends to have a biology of its own and a behavior of its own, which we, as yet, are not as good at influencing as we might be. People often ask about green tea who are in this phase of CLL. And as many of you know, this has been systematically studied at the Mayo Clinic for people in watch and wait phase of CLL. And they did find that about a third of people, their white count came down, and more than that had some improvement in lymph nodes. But the study itself was really designed to define a dose of the green tea that was well tolerated rather than to truly show effectiveness. And they did find that it was generally well tolerated, but, you know, we really don't know the effectiveness. We don't know if decreasing the white count a little bit is helpful. It's even because it may not change that ultimate biology of the CLL. And there's even the possibility that exposing the CLL to the green tea could potentially induce changes in the CLL. So we really need more studies, I think, on green tea before we can recommend it. That being said, people who like to drink green tea or find that they feel better, like they're doing something, taking a low dose of it, I don't actively discourage that because I recognize that that is potentially helpful for people psychologically feeling like they're coping with their disease. Similarly, there's been a recent study suggesting that low vitamin D levels might increase the chances that CLL will progress. And again, it's one study. It didn't show any difference in the ultimate outcomes, and so it's not something that I would recommend. On the other hand, the replacement doses of vitamin D that are present in multivitamins, for example, are not likely to do any harm. And it does allow people to potentially feel like they're doing something. But it's not something that medically we can recommend for CLL at this time. So those are questions that have come up a lot with my patients in sort of the watch and wait phase of the disease. If we move on to people who have moved into the treatment phase, I think one question that always comes up is that people are very, very afraid of treatment, which is natural because it often includes chemotherapy. There are a lot of side effects. We've all heard horror stories. But I do think that the treatments that we give for CLL are generally better tolerated than people think, and people feel better and are able to carry on with their normal activities much more so than they expect. We have very good medications for nausea now and are much better at dealing with sort of classic chemotherapy side effects than we used to be. And so this really brings up the importance of sharing whatever you're experiencing with your healthcare team, because if you don't let us know how things are going for you, we can't help you. And oftentimes we may have something to offer that may help you, but we won't know unless you tell us what you need. And so that's really, really important. And especially if you're on treatment, if you start to feel sick or if you get a fever, you really need to contact your healthcare professional because we need to check and make sure that nothing potentially worrisome is occurring in that type of situation. In order to prevent fevers or complications of treatment, we have a variety of things that we do for CLL patients. I'm a big fan of using antibiotics that can prevent infections from developing during therapy. We have antibiotics that can prevent shingles, for example, or herpes virus sores. We also have an antibiotic that can prevent a special kind of pneumonia that can be potentially dangerous. We have growth factors that we can give to keep the normal white cells of the immune system in a good range to help prevent infections from occurring. In that light, it's very, very important to keep up with your immunizations. I always recommend influenza shots every year and generally pneumonia shots every 3 to 5 years. It is important generally to stay away from live virus vaccines if you have CLL, especially CLL that's been treated. But that's something that you can consult with your doctor about. But generally, we do try to avoid those. And if you've had your spleen out, for example, then there are several vaccines you need to get every 3 to 5 years to help prevent infections. One thing that comes up frequently is the use of intravenous immune globulin. This is like a replacement antibody, which we sometimes give to people with CLL who have had frequent infections and who have low levels of antibodies that they themselves are making. This is generally something that we reserve for exactly that situation, where the normal antibody levels are low and where people have had real, sustained, usually bacterial infections, because that's a situation in which we have some evidence that this immune globulin can decrease the risk of recurrent infections anyway. And sometimes for people who've had a lot of prior treatment who are getting very, very immunosuppressive therapies like alemtuzumab or Campath or high-dose steroids, sometimes then we'll use this in a preventative way, but generally we don't use that. And you heard from Dr. Coutre about some of the new drugs that we're currently evaluating in CLL, and I think we're all extremely excited about these in the community because they're pills. They have had remarkable effectiveness in people who have had many other treatments, and they seem to be really quite safe. And so we're hopeful that as these agents come to the fore, maybe we'll have less potential complications of treatment, less infections, and that these drugs combined with chemotherapy may be able to get rid of CLL for extended periods, or that they can even be used as maintenance, as individual drugs, and that during that time, people will feel well and not have the complications that have been associated with chemotherapy. And so it's a really a very exciting time in CLL. And I also would very strongly encourage you to consider clinical trials if they're available to you in your area, because really this is how we get these drugs available for all of us to use, by people being willing to participate in trials. And it's how we learn more about how best to treat and hopefully eventually cure CLL. That's what I wanted to say.
So I want to thank you very much, Dr. Brown, for just a very comprehensive and very excellent presentation. Lots of different concerns that many of people living with CLL experience. You've really covered quite a bit, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Brian Tomlinson. Brian is Chief Program Officer, Lymphoma Research Foundation. Brian has also really been the architect of today's program, really has been the person responsible for really making this program possible. And he's going to say, really update you on some of the wonderful programs at the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Brian?
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and welcome to everybody on the call. We're so pleased, as Carolyn said, when the call started to have so many of you from all across the United States and the world joining us today. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge Cancer Care and Carolyn and her wonderful team for a great relationship and partnership for a number of years. We work with Cancer Care on all of the teleconferencing that we do for patients, and we really appreciate and value the relationship there. I'd like to thank Drs. Brown and Coutre for their excellent and informative presentations. We appreciate them taking time out of their very busy schedules to join us for this call and to provide all of this information to all of you on the call. I'd like to thank the sponsors of today's program, Cephalon Oncology and GlaxoSmithKline. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit. We're devoted exclusively to funding innovative lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with information on the disease. We are committed to helping people and meeting the needs of people with CLL. Our mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. We've invested over $45 million in research, including nearly $2.5 million on translational research specific to CLL. We offer a number of programs and services for all of you on the phone and all people affected by all of the different subtypes of lymphoma, including our lymphoma helpline, where you can contact a member of our team to learn more about your disease, treatment options, clinical trials, or resources within your community. You heard Drs. Coutre and Brown talk today about clinical trials. We offer a clinical trials information service where a member of our helpline team will do customized, individual, tailored searches for you based on your treatment history and where you live. We have a national lymphoma support network that connects people that have similar lymphoma or CLL-related experiences. We have a limited financial assistance program that provides financial support to patients currently undergoing treatment. We have a variety of CLL-specific publications in print and electronic format. We have an over 80-page CLL comprehensive disease guide, a CLL fact sheet, and a CLL disease-specific website that we've developed in collaboration with the Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Information Group, and that website is cllinfogroup.org. We have a variety of webcasts and podcasts specific to your disease and specific to the different subtypes of lymphoma. We offer a variety of patient conferences on the regional work on the regional level. We have lymphoma workshops that offer CLL disease-specific breakout sessions, as well as our annual educational forum that has several sessions devoted exclusively to CLL. For more information about any of these programs or services, I encourage you all to contact a member of our helpline team by calling us at 1-800-500-9976, emailing us at helpline@lymphoma.org, or visiting our website, lymphoma.org. Before I close, again, I want to stress our commitment to helping people affected by CLL. The Lymphoma Research Foundation has a dedicated full-time staff person that focuses exclusively on CLL outreach within the community. If you haven't heard from him already, you soon will be. I thank Carolyn, Cancer Care, Drs. Brown and Coutre, and the sponsors of today's program. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. Wonderful, really, just a wonderful resource on the Lymphoma Research Foundation for everyone on the call today. I just want to say actually a few words about Cancer Care Services, and then we'll take questions from all of you. Cancer Care is an organization that provides services throughout the United States, and we actually have a call center that's staffed by about 50 master's level trained oncology social workers. And we provide a host of services at no cost to anyone who calls us. And we provide actually support services, so a chance to talk with one of our social workers about your concerns. We also offer a range of support groups from telephone and online support groups, depending on which technology you're most comfortable with. We also offer financial assistance, and as well as a number of publications and materials, fact sheets about cancer. And, of course, we do have a number of these workshops that we offer throughout the year as become podcasts after they occur. And so we have a lot of informational pieces that are available to all of you as well. So our telephone number is 1-800-813-HOPE. And our website is www.cancercare.org. We welcome you to call our call center for assistance and help, and we're here to help you. And most importantly, we don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with CLL or cancer or any of your concerns. We want you to feel that you're part of a support community that we can assist you and provide help and assistance to each of you. And now we have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Melina to explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Melina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Jeff J.
Hi. What does the amount of deletion, the percentage of deletion, really mean?
Thank you for that question. Dr. Coutre, could you address that?
So usually it's expressed in terms of a percentage of the CLL cells that are involved, and it is important in some cases because if there's just a small number, or small percentage of the cells involved, we're not really sure how important that is. So when you say, for example, there's a 17p deletion, we are interested in what percentage of the CLL cells are involved.
And Dr. Brown, would you want to add anything to that? Or?
But with most of the other cytogenetic abnormalities, we're not as interested in the percentage. It's really with the 17p deletion.
Thank you. Okay, our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Paul Y. Paul, your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I'm 58, was diagnosed with atypical CLL, bordering on marginal zone lymphoma 5 years ago. I've been asymptomatic except for slight fatigue and falling platelets. So unlike other patients, falling platelets has been the number one issue, and it was felt I require treatment because treatment causes platelets to fall further. They were in the 80 range. So I've had FCR, and I've had the bone marrow examination recently, and the percentage lymphocyte population went from 70 to roughly 3%, double that in terms of the absolute lymphocyte population.
And your question, Paul?
Yeah, the question is, I'm a bit confused about the extent of my remission. There's also this black cloud of marginal zone. I mean, I guess that's usual with atypical CLL. So can you shed some light on the remission status based on the numbers that provided?
Well, I want to thank you, Paul, for that really excellent question. A couple of questions there. I'm going to ask our speakers to address your question in a general way, and then please feel free to call us afterwards, or I'll contact you so we can be sure that we've covered all of your concerns. Dr. Brown, do you want to go first in terms of addressing this question?
Sure. I think the general aspect of the question is after treatment, sort of what is the quality of remission, or how do we define remission? So generally, a complete remission means that there's really no evidence remaining of the CLL visible when we look at the bone marrow or in terms of increased lymphocyte cells. It also means that lymph nodes are no longer palpable at all and are reduced to normal size. Of late, on clinical trials, we're interested in a special subset of complete remission, which we call actually evaluating for minimal residual disease and looking to see if the bone marrow is negative for minimal residual disease. And that means using very special, highly sensitive tests called flow cytometry, we don't see any evidence of the CLL. And so that's sort of a subcategory of complete remission. And then a partial remission generally means that there's still some evidence of the disease present. Often that may be only in the bone marrow. Sometimes it can be with lymph nodes that are a little above normal size still. And generally, there's not really a simple answer to what we're striving to achieve. Obviously, getting completely rid of the disease as much as possible is desirable, but it's not always better to give more and more therapy to try to achieve that, because sometimes the therapy can cause complications and can actually lower the normal blood counts or cause other problems. And so it's really on a very individual basis with your doctor that you would sort of need to discuss the quality of your remission and whether you're happy with that and what your doctor sees going forward.
Excellent. Thank you. Dr. Coutre, would you like to add anything? Or?
No, I'd just like to emphasize what Jennifer mentioned about complete responses. When you're looking at studies and you're seeing that, gosh, we gave FCR and two-thirds of patients had a complete response, that means you feel well, your exam is normal without enlarged lymph nodes, your blood counts have recovered, and your bone marrow has a normal number of lymphocytes. So, for example, in this case, the bone marrow description is a complete response. But that does not mean that there still isn't some CLL present. So if we want to look more carefully, we can do that. But that's really the context, in the context of clinical trials and whether to treat minimal residual disease, et cetera.
Very helpful. I hope that's helpful to you, Paul, and thank you for excellent questions. I have to say these are wonderful questions. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Benny M.
Benny Manish?
Yes. Hi,
yes,
Benny.
This is me. This is about my wife. She's only 52 years old, and about 15 months ago, we found out that she had CLL. But the doctor said they cannot do anything at the moment. Maybe it takes about 10 more years. They don't do anything. Her white blood cell is about 19, and the lymphocyte is about 19 or 22. Is it anything that she can do or nothing at the moment?
That's an excellent question. Thank you. I'm going to ask Dr. Brown to address that because I think that Dr. Brown Could you address that issue?
Sure. So that comes back to what I was talking about when I was talking about the watch and wait or the watch and worry. You know, it sounds like your wife feels fine. Her white count is low. And so the doctor hasn't recommended any treatment. And, you know, that's scary because, you know, you want to do something about it. But actually, if you turn it around, it's good because it means that the CLL isn't causing any problems yet. And hopefully the CLL may not cause any problems for a long time. And this is part of why we have the watch and wait process, because some people are diagnosed with CLL but may never need treatment. And the best information we can get about that is from watching and seeing what happens with the disease. And so it's true that there's nothing that we can recommend at this point that to change things. But on the other hand, you know, she feels well and she should live her life.
And I hope that helps any. And Dr. Coutre, did you want to add to that?
No.
Okay. Right. And that's really, and I think, Benny, we are happy to also talk with you both at the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care in terms of just that whole issue of getting on with the momentum of one's life when you know that you have a diagnosis of CLL, but that indeed at this point treatment isn't required at this point, and to not have that. And, of course, that will be a cause of worry and concern. We want to be sure that you and your wife and family can get on with all of the things of your life that give it such importance and meaning. So that's really so very important. So thank you for that excellent question. I think there may be other people on the call with questions like yours, so thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Brett M.
Yes, I wanted to know if there are any advances being made for folks that have the 17p deletion.
Okay. Thank you for that question. Dr. Coutre, could you address that question?
Yes. Well, we know, for example, that one of the approved antibodies, alemtuzumab, tends to work independent of that mechanism of resistance, so that's an available drug. And then the data we have so far about the two investigational drugs I mentioned, the BTK inhibitor and the CAL-101 drug, seem to show that they work just fine, even in patients who have the 17p deletion. So that's a very exciting observation.
Okay, excellent. And Dr. Brown, did you want to add anything? Or?
I'll just add that for patients who are young enough and otherwise healthy, we have often tried to move towards stem cell transplant for those who have 17p deletion. And in the last couple of years, for the first time, we've had evidence that that actually really does work, that people are in long-term remissions 5 years or more, even with 17p deletion after stem cell transplant. And so that is something that's on the table in the appropriate setting as well.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, these are great questions. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Carney P.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. It's my understanding that certain drugs are more effective under certain circumstances, such as enlarged nodes and spleen versus asymptomatic, where the disease is more in the peripheral blood and marrow. What do you know? Can you explain what you know about which drugs are more effective in either circumstance? That's my question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Dr. Brown, would you like to address that?
Sure. It is the case that, especially as people have been treated before, we see different qualities of response in blood and bone marrow versus large lymph nodes or spleen with different therapies. And one of the very obvious examples of that is the approved antibody alemtuzumab. Is extremely effective at clearing blood and bone marrow disease, but really does not work very well in large lymph nodes. And so it's a drug that can be extremely effective in the right context for people whose disease is primarily in the blood and marrow, but not so useful with large lymph nodes. And also in the setting of relapse after prior chemotherapy, in terms of large lymph nodes, there is a regimen that is becoming more widespread using basically high-dose steroids, like high-dose prednisone with rituximab, which can be quite effective in shrinking large lymph nodes. The other thing is that the new drugs, the CAL-101 drug, has shown actually very good effectiveness in shrinking large lymph nodes, even in the situations of 17p or 11q deletion or with very refractory disease.
Thank you. And Dr. Coutre, would you like to add anything?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Susan K.
Hello?
Hello, Susan. Hi, your question, please.
Yes, I wanted to know, I was diagnosed at age 65 with CLL at stage zero with no symptoms. As you can guess, it came as a complete surprise. All of a sudden, I was told I had leukemia, and, you know, I went off to play tennis. And I do have CD38. I do not have ZAP70, and my hematologist says I have no other prognostic markers. Can you develop these as time goes on?
Excellent. Dr. Couture, would you like to address that?
So the things such as mutational status do not change over time. What can change over time is the chromosomal abnormalities. We've talked about the 17P and the 13Q. And so that could become relevant as people progress, or if they've had a lot of prior treatment, you tend to see a higher percentage of the 17P deletion, for example, in those individuals compared to those who are initially diagnosed. So in that setting, it can change, and it can influence what you choose for treatment. But the other factors really aren't relevant later in the disease course. ZAP70, for example, or the mutational status, they really don't influence choice of treatment.
Excellent. And Dr. Brown, did you want to add anything? Or?
No.
Okay, all right. Our next, it's such a wonderful thing to have two wonderful speakers on the call and really to have them both such experts. It's really terrific. And our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Evelyn B.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm at watch and wait for 10 years now, and I'm 80 years old, and I've never had any kind of treatment, and I have no B symptoms. Can you tell me what is a marker to look for to initiate treatment, and what treatments do you recommend for real senior people?
Okay. I'm going to ask Dr. Brown to address your question. It's a wonderful question. I suspect many people on the call have a similar question. Dr. Brown?
Okay. So, you know, the reasons for therapy, which Dr. Couture had mentioned, are really pretty standard regardless of age. And they include if the normal blood cell counts, the normal red blood cells or the platelets, are dropping steadily and drop below a certain level, and that's usually due to the CLL in the bone marrow, or symptoms from the disease, which you indicated that you don't have, which is good, or if there are large lymph nodes that are starting to become uncomfortable or cause problems or organ problems. You know, if you've been on watch and wait for 10 years, and if the white count hasn't changed much, it may not change much for some time. If it's been steadily going up, then it may be the case that over time, as it continues to go up, the red blood count or the platelets would drop, and that would probably be a common indication for treatment in that situation. And in terms of treatments for older individuals, it unfortunately is an area that we really haven't studied as well in clinical trials as we would wish. In Europe, they have actually studied it some, and they actually compared fludarabine to chlorambucil, the very old pill drug, which has been around for decades. And they actually didn't find any benefit of the fludarabine compared to the chlorambucil for older people. And following on that, they've added Rituxan to chlorambucil, which seemed to improve responses compared to chlorambucil. And now they're doing a large trial actually comparing chlorambucil to chlorambucil with Rituxan to chlorambucil with a brand new antibody that is supposed to be a new and improved Rituxan. And so that is sort of the extent of some of the established trial information that we have. I think most of us kind of work with a variety of options that might include the chlorambucil Rituxan or potentially lower dose chemotherapies like reduced doses of fludarabine with Rituxan. Very often I try to have a clinical trial available often of something that avoids chemotherapy. Like, for example, I think Dr. Couture alluded to a trial of the Cal-101 with Rituxan, which would be a very excellent type of option because those drugs are very, very well tolerated. And hopefully moving forward in coming years, we'll have some of these options that avoid chemotherapy and are very well tolerated drugs. For now, it's really very, very individualized depending on what the reason that we need to treat is and how well the person is otherwise. And so it's very, very individual.
And I wonder if Dr. Brown, Dr. Coutre, if you could comment on just the, for someone on watchful weight, what is the monitoring or what are the, I know it has to be individualized, but is there some guidelines you can give people in terms of the frequency of their perhaps visits or their follow-up care, that if you could just address that?
Well, I think that really depends on the individual. Often when you're recently diagnosed, your physician may elect to check things a little more frequently, perhaps every 3-4 months, just to get a sense of the pace of the disease. Is this stable, or is there some signs of early progression? But more typically, I would say anywhere from 6 to 12 months, visit to a physician would be common.
And if a person develops a question in between those visits, because I know that often comes up as an issue, could you both comment on just how you encourage your the people who see you for care, what you suggest that they do if they have questions between those visits?
Well, what we typically do when we have this initial discussion is we describe kind of what to expect if things are changing. So we say if there's anything out of the ordinary, you're noticing some new lymph nodes or they're enlarging, or you're developing new symptoms like fatigue, night sweats, things that are just unusual. They're not something that you expect, and you wonder if they're related to your disease. Then we actually encourage them to give us a call so we can help sort them out and decide whether or not we need to see them for an evaluation.
And Dr. Brown, is that?
In the beginning, I often see people every 3 months for a couple of visits so that hopefully they can get a lot of the questions answered, like follow-on questions from the first visit, that sort of thing, and then go to every 6 months. And then if things are stable, every year. And, you know, I do email for simple questions, but if anyone has real symptoms like Dr. Coutre was mentioning or concerns of that nature, then just strongly encourage them to call. That's what we were talking about, communicating with your healthcare team if you're worried about something.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You have just been really extraordinary. This is an extraordinary call, and in so many ways, just remarkable. I want to thank you. I also want to thank all of you who asked such great questions. I know you ask the questions to get information for your own in situation, but you also end up helping everybody on the call by asking your question. And I want to also thank everyone who's been listening as well. This is a very large call. Everyone didn't get to ask their question. So please know that you can call either Lymphoma Research Foundation or Cancer Care if you have a question that you didn't get to ask and you want some help, or if a follow-up question that you'd like some help with. Also, in planning a program like this, we want you each to know that you have resources when this program ends. So this is a one-hour education workshop, but that, indeed, in planning a program like this, we know that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I just want you all to know that you do have wonderful resources. You have the Lymphoma Research Foundation, you have Cancer Care, and then all the collaborating organizations, and you have all that information in your materials. Do take advantage of those resources. They all are free. They're all very informational. Certainly, Lymphoma Research Foundation is a terrific resource for each of you. It has wonderful materials for you. And I just can't encourage you enough to not feel like you're always alone in trying to cope. You also have your healthcare team, of course, and there are questions that only your healthcare team can address. But often these other organizations can help you with some just general information that help you to ask perhaps more informed questions when you see your healthcare team and could be very useful to you, or provide you with support and counseling that could just be really helpful to you in dealing with whatever concerns you might be dealing with. So most importantly, as we conclude, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support. You have lots of organizations out there, lots of people who really want to help you. So I want to thank you all for participating in this program today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.